Hey, scaredy cats, the 80s were all about the werewolf movie. You had Teen Wolf, Full Moon High, Teen Wolf 2, The Company of Wolves, Silver Bullet. But 1981 was truly a banner year if you liked to howl at the moon, with not one, but three werewolf movies coming out. Howlin', An American Werewolf in London, and the movie we're going to talk about today, The Howling. Joining the pack to discuss The Howling are return guests Jessica and Brian. Hey, folks, how are you doing?
Great.
Very happy
to be back.
Absolutely.
Jessica has written articles for Film Cred, Nightmarish Conjurings, and Grimm, and has a podcast called Monster Books Podcast and a horror comics column on Daily Grindhouse. And Brian is a regular contributor to Bloody Disgusting, Manor Vellum, Council of Zoom, and is co-host of the Movies for Life podcast. Well, we're going to talk about werewolf movies in the next two episodes. So today we're going to talk about The Howling. And then our next episode is An American Werewolf in London. Mm-hmm. So on that theme, what are your favorite werewolf movies?
Well, you've named two of them already, obviously. I mean, I'm not going to speak for everybody, but werewolves are my favorite movie monsters, and I'm obsessed with werewolf movies, and those are two of my favorites. I'm also partial to The Wolfman, the 1941 Universal Monsters classic. I love Ginger Snaps. I think that's a classic of the werewolf subgenre. And also Dog Soldiers. I'm a huge fan of Dog Soldiers as well. So,
yeah, The Howling is probably my favorite, to be honest. Maybe it's because of the time I saw it. I recognize that American Werewolf in London is probably a better movie, but I just really love this one. I really love The Howling. Yeah, and same with me. I'm a big fan of The Wolfman. I recently finally watched Werewolf of London, the sort of the precursor that came out in 1935, which is an interesting movie. I think it's pretty good. I probably going to have to check it out again just to see. But I've become a really big fan of Wolfen, also from 1981.
Yeah.
Though it's technically not a werewolf movie. Mm-hmm. It's a werewolf movie. so I think that one's really, and Jessica, you basically said them all that I love. So,
sorry, I stole all the answers.
No, it's all good. The one that I haven't seen, I saw it once on television many years ago, and I really need to revisit it, is Ginger Snaps. Just not very familiar with that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah. I rewatched that one last year. I saw it. I don't remember how old I was, but it was pretty early on in my werewolf studies, and I just fell in love with it. I'm a huge fan of that movie. And also shout out to Trick or Treat for having a really good werewolf story in it.
Definitely.
It does have a really good werewolf story in it, for sure.
You know, I would be remiss as a Wes Craven fan, though, for not mentioning. I gotta mention Cursed. Yes, it's a mess, but I have a lot of fun with that movie. I gotta admit.
I still have not seen that one. I know I see Ryan Larson talk about it a lot on Twitter, and I'm like, I really need to check that out because I love Wes Craven and I love werewolves. So, you know, I'm a bad horror fan for not seeing that one, I think.
No, you're not a bad horror fan for not seeing Curse, trust me. But it's definitely flawed, but I find it to be, there are things about it that I really like. It's, like I said, it's a mess, but I don't know, something about the werewolf flipping the bird and all that stuff. I find that stuff hilarious.
I watched it for the first time last night, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I was a saint. Like, I had a lot of fun with it. And I had read that it was a big mess of a movie. And I mean, you can definitely see its flaws, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I revisited it because I've been writing this series on Wes Craven. And so I revisited it for the third part of that series that's coming out soon. And every time I watch it, it's kind of like I like it a little bit more, I think, because even though it is uneven and all those things, it's still just kind of a blast if you just let yourself go with the ride.
So the very first werewolf movie was released in 1913, and it was just called The Werewolf. It was a movie about a Native American woman seeking revenge for the death of her lover. Unfortunately, there are no prints of the movie still in existence. So the first one available for us to watch is, as you mentioned, Werewolf of London, mm-hmm. which was released in 1935. The Wolfman was probably the first werewolf movie that I saw. It came out in 1941. Actually, that's not true. Teen Wolf. I would have seen Teen Wolf before The Wolfman, let's be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
The special effects by the absolute legend Jack Pierce were way ahead of their time. And the movie was directed by George Wagner, a name that will become quite familiar to us as we watch The Howling. And there were four sequels to The Wolfman because it was such a success. Now, not really too much happened in the 50s. I think sci-fi and aliens became all the rage.
The one that I can think of is I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Right.
With Michael Landon. Sorry, I probably stole your thunder, what you were going to say there.
Go ahead.
I don't know much about it. I haven't seen it. So I've seen bits of it, but I've never seen the whole thing.
And then I think the 60s and 70s saw a lot of like exploitation werewolf movies. You had a lot of international movies coming out. I think there was some Mexican, some Spanish movies.
One I definitely got to mention that I forgot about that's in this era, though, is Hammer's Curse of the Werewolf. With Oliver Reed.
Oh, yes. That's also on my to-watch list because I love Oliver Reed. I'm very behind on my Hammer viewing, though.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed that one because that is definitely one of my favorites of the werewolf genre. Just a really interesting take on it all, and it's great film. Really good film.
And then the 80s, there was an explosion of werewolf movies. So what do you think... Like, what was behind that? What made werewolves part of the zeitgeist of the 80s, if you will?
I think one of the things that happened was you have kids who grew up with watching The Wolfman and seeing movies like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and Curse of the Werewolf. You have them coming of age kind of around the same time. And saying, hey, there hasn't been a really good werewolf movie in a while, you know? And I honestly think that's what happened between, you know, John Sayles, Joe Dante, and John Landis, is they just kind of said, you know, I really would like to see a werewolf movie. I haven't seen mm-hmm. one in a long time, you know? And that's where I think the impetus came from, at least with the 1981 explosion. I don't know. It just kind of was in the air. And special effects had gotten to a point where you could do something more interesting. Something new that hadn't been seen before. Which had, you know, kind of first become apparent, you know, even like the year before, you know. I mean, obviously Landis had written American Werewolf a long time before it got made. But you had, you know, Dick Smith doing stuff in Altered States and different things like mm-hmm. that, where you could see, you know, some of these weird transformational things kind of happen right. in real time. And so having that as another element to put into your werewolf movie, I think was really appealing too.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with some really, really intelligent, really philosophical answer about, you know, the nature of transformation and how that affected people. But really, I think it is just, you know, this perfect storm of the right talent coming on the right idea at the right time and technology catching up with these transformations. And it just kind of snowballed. Like, you know, Michael Jackson famously wanted Landis to do the Thriller video because of American Werewolf in London. And it just kind of snowballed because people realized how amazing werewolf stories can be. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to come up with a deep answer, but I've just got to echo Brian. People just wanted more werewolves in their movies, and they had kind of an explosion of really talented, really smart people doing it with amazing effects.
That makes sense. I am trying to like reach him. Like, is there something about the excess of the 80s and like the werewolf as an expression of like instant gratification? And but
And I was trying to go back to like the 70s and like, mm-hmm. you know, counterculture of the late 60s and then mm-hmm. how political the 70s were, and, you know, the turmoil of undergoing this violent transformation every month. And, you know, I'm trying to tie it back in, like dealing with ginger snaps and with like where panthers in cat people, how it's tied into female sexuality. But these are very like American Werewolf is very male centric, but as we see in The Howling, it's very much tied to sexuality and there's a strong female presence. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm reaching and I'm not getting anything. So
Well, I know Landis has even said that the transformation scene in American Werewolf was essential. I know we keep on talking about that one, but it was very much, you know, like a puberty metaphor.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, he didn't say like an erection metaphor. And so, which is like, okay, I get it. I see it actually. But so there's definitely that there. And I think that's, you know, The Howling and American Werewolf will be forever linked because they came out the same year and they had, you know, Rick Baker, you know, briefly worked on The Howling before mm-hmm. being taken to do the other and all these sorts of things. So they're going to always be linked, but they are doing such different things.
Oh, absolutely.
They're so different.
Yeah. That I think they're kind of unfairly linked.
I'd agree. Yeah. They've got such different ideas and such different tones, even though mm-hmm. they both marry comedy and horror really brilliantly, they're doing it so differently.
Yeah.
I'd agree with that.
Let's talk about The Howling. The IMDb summary is, after a bizarre and nearly deadly encounter with a serial killer, a television newswoman is sent to a remote mountain resort whose residents may not be what they seem. I mean, it's pretty much a cult, so
yeah. And they even name check cults, you know, when Dawn is like, well, I tried Scientology and I tried this and then I decided to try the colony, so mm-hmm. yeah.
And we'll get to it, but I love the line after she's like lists all the things that she's done and she's like, I figure in like 5 years I'll be like a full human being. So it was directed by Joe Dante, as we talked about, and he really wanted it to be a very self-aware movie. So characters live in a world where werewolves, well, maybe they don't know that werewolves exist, but when they find out, they're like, oh, it's a werewolf, right? Instead of those things where they're like, what is happening?
Right.
And he paid for the movie clips himself because he wanted that to be very obvious. So there's movie clips and cartoon clips throughout the movie with different werewolves and stuff in it. So he really wanted it to be blatant that this happens in this universe. The screenplay was by John Sayles. Joe Dante had worked with him previously on one of my favorite movies, Piranha.
Yes.
And Terrence H. Winkless. And it was based on the novel by Gary Brandner. The novel was released in 1977, was part of a trilogy. But Joe Dante was very critical of the book and would often talk about how it wasn't very good. And they'd actually improved it for the movie. He had an incident where he was doing a lecture at the Hollywood Scriptwriting Institute and he was bad-mouthing the book. Somebody in the audience raised their hand and said, so you don't like the book, huh? And Dante said, well, no, not really. And the man in the audience replied, I wrote that book. Awkward.
Yeah.
Have either of you read the book, The Howling?
I have not.
I've started it a couple of times and haven't gotten very far.
To be so you'd honest. Agree with that assessment?
thus far, it's available on Kindle. Like the whole trilogy, you can get on Kindle for fairly inexpensive, actually. So I have it, and I just, I've tried it a couple of times and just have never gotten into it.
All right. Well, I don't know if that's a ringing endorsement, so I don't know that I will really. Get that.
I'm sorry to say. I'll let you know if I ever do finish it. I'll set the story straight. How's that?
Okay.
If only the author could pop into the podcast right now to defend his book. I wrote that book.
Yeah.
Thanks, Brian.
Oh, that was a missed opportunity.
I know.
So the original screenplay, wasn't originally written by Sayles. It was written by Jack Conrad, who was the original director, and Terrence H. Winkless. They played it very straightforward, much more faithful to the book. But Conrad and Winkless were kind of cut from the project, and Joe Dante and John Sayles were brought on. Sayles specifically worked around the rules of werewolf lore. So he was like, if you have a werewolf who can only change during the full moon, you have a month between changes. It's kind of a boring movie. So they made a lot of changes, like the werewolves can change at will, whether it's day or night, they can kind of change whenever they want to.
I kind of like that element. That sort of brings it back to more like the shapeshifter lore of, you know, like Native American lore and things like that, which I think is interesting. But it also ties into, you know, Sayles was looking into psychology and stuff like that. And he saw the werewolf as a metaphor for the id.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's how he approached it, which I thought was really interesting when I was sort of researching some stuff on the movie itself. So.
And the new screenplay had much more of a humorous tone. The movie stars Dee Wallace, Patrick McNee, Dennis Dugan, and Robert Picardo. It was Robert Picardo's debut film role and his first of 10 movies with Joe Dante. I always enjoy when directors use the same actors over and over again.
Oh, me too. Me too. And Picardo's always so much fun in Joe Dante movies.
Mm-hmm.
I just revisited Matinee for the podcast, and he's just so much fun in that movie. And I just... He's so different in this, you know, so dark and scary in this. And then, you know, you see him in something like The Burbs, where he's the garbage man, or in Matinee. And it's just so different. It's like, how is this the same guy? It's just incredible.
I went a really long time, even though I had seen his name in the credits, I went a really long time without realizing exactly who Eddie Quist was. Mm-hmm. And when I found out that it really was Robert Picardo, it kind of blew my mind, which is shameful since I had seen his name in the credits every single time I watched the movie. Right. But you're right. He's so different and he has such a different energy here than anywhere else that it's kind of hard for me to reconcile my image of Robert Picardo with that character.
Mm-hmm. He apparently tried to channel Clint Eastwood to be as menacing as possible.
So the whole sort of the gravelly voice, I'm going to light up your whole body, Karen, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I promised myself I wasn't going to try and do a bunch of imitations on
this. I loved this your episode. Imitations during the Exorcist episode. Maren. It was great. I always try and do them and they always like are terrible. So I appreciate
mine are pretty terrible too, but I'll do it. It's kind of fun to just gotta throw
them. I'll never attempt them. They're too awful. I'll let y'all take care of that for me.
As we mentioned, Rick Baker was originally supposed to do the special effects for the movie, but he left to do, you know, the other big werewolf movie of the year, An American Werewolf in London. And he left the effects in the hands of his assistant, who was only 21 at the time the movie was made. I did nothing of merit when I was 21 years old. just saying.
Yeah. And like the 2 years, because the thing came out in 82, correct?
Yes, I believe so.
The thing came out in 82.
Yeah. Those 2 years for Rob Bottin, like, I can't imagine at any age having two consecutive years like that in your career, let alone like two of the like biggest classics in terms of practical effects, like in the history of cinema. I've been in awe of him my whole life. It's incredible. Yeah.
The art director was Robert A. Burns, and he had previously worked on the sets for Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh.
A lot of the set dressings were actually things that he brought from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, he also worked on The Hills Have Eyes.
Yes, so yeah.
That's Yeah, so that you can see. I had never drawn that conclusion, but now it's like it's leaping
exactly
you know, off the screen at me. That's funny. Oh God,
the master of rural terror.
Yeah.
In fact, the corpse in the armchair in the bookstore is the grandmother from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Jeez.
I read
you know
that.
How dumb I feel right now. How many? I have seen this movie dozens of times, and I have never picked up on that.
Right? There were so many things I picked up on this last rewatch. Like, I've tweeted about how dumb I felt when I was like, wait, is that Forrest J. Ackerman in the bookstore?
Yeah. See, that I had gotten. I was like, yeah, there. Now this, I'm like, oh, man.
It's amazing that you can watch a movie so many times and each time pick up on something different.
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, little things that, you know, wouldn't stand out the first time or the second time or however many times, and just sometimes you catch it.
Yeah, and it comes from, like, I've been watching a lot of Roger Corman movies lately, and I clocked Roger Corman for the first time in this viewing, which again, I'm embarrassed to say it's the first time I noticed it.
Same.
But just noticing all these things pop up and just thinking, oh man, I wish I had gotten that and been a cool kid the first time I watched it.
That's, I think Joe Dante is a master of those little, like, subtle Easter eggs. Like, they're throughout this whole movie. It's incredible.
Yeah.
The movie took 28 days to shoot and was released on March 13th, 1981. The budget was $1.5 million. Box office, any guesses?
No idea.
I got nothing.
80 million?
17.9 million.
American Werewolf was probably more like.
Yeah. I blame Roger Ebert because he only gave it a 2 out of 4 star review and said that it was the silliest film seen in some time. He did say the special effects were noteworthy, and the film was worth your money if you get it 2 for 1.
Good Lord.
Well,
that's
okay.
An interesting compliment.
Well.
His compatriot Siskel, however, gave it 3.5 stars out of 4. And Variety praised the film's sense of humor and also its approach to horror. It won the 1981 Saturn Award for Best Horror Film and was also nominated for Best Makeup and Best Special Effects.
Wow.
I think it's done as, from what I understand, a lot of Joe Dante's movies, it's done better as time has gone by.
Yeah, that seems to be the case with him. I mean, except for Gremlins. Gremlins yes. was sort of an instant hit, but... Mm-hmm. Most of the others, it takes time for people to come around on them, which is, does that say they're ahead of their time, maybe, a little? It's possible. But I think maybe it's the, you know, the mixture of horror and humor that he always goes for, I mm-hmm. should say. And sometimes people have a tough time latching on to that.
True.
So the movie starts with the classic werewolf howl, and the name of the movie is basically slashed across the screen in bright red letters before being broken like glass, and we start getting these news and media flashes across the screen. It's just kind of blue static, but we're getting the sound of these news flashes. We hear about a series of savage murders before we see Dr. George Wagner, played by Patrick McNee, talking on screen about repression. He's on a TV show talking about not denying the beast within.
That is just the most ironic speech that he gives at the beginning of the movie, because that's all he's doing to mm-hmm. his community. The rest of the movie is repressing them.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I love how immediately it's really disorienting, and I'm not going to draw parallels between this and American Werewolf the whole time, but they're a very typical, you know, we're on the foggy moors, you know, mm-hmm. but here it's a really high tech, it's opening, it's a city with all these like sleazy, grimy establishments. It's very modern, and it mm-hmm. really sets itself apart in terms of werewolf movies right away, which I always loved.
Yeah, I really like that too.
Even watching the movie and taking my notes, at one point I was like, just go back to LA. There are no werewolves in LA. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's how the whole movie starts. Like, but you're so used to that kind of idea of like you said, the werewolves on the moors or in the woods. And
right.
Meanwhile, Eddie has settled in Los Angeles.
Well, another thing that's really interesting about the that I rarely think about, but it just sort of popped out at me this time during under the credits, you know, while the static is going on the screen and stuff, there are lines of dialogue from mm-hmm. the whole movie.
Exactly.
Going on all the way to the end, you know, so it's practically giving away elements and it, but you only know that if you've seen it. So it's kind of cool the way that's done. It's sort of, and it's almost like an overture, you know, where you hear bits of music, you know, from the whole show before.
Yeah,
before
that's a great analogy.
Yeah, so I like that.
Exactly.
Dr. Wagner's talking about the struggle between mind and body. It's an unnecessary struggle. He says it causes too much turmoil. Dr. Wagner is a therapist. He's been working with a local news anchor, Karen White, played by Dee Wallace, who was in the very first movie that I saw in the theaters ever in my life.
E.T.?
E.T.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll always be Elliot's mom to me.
Yeah, that was one of my first as well, actually.
Nice.
Probably mine as well. I don't remember, but I would be willing to bet.
So he's working with Karen White and the police in an attempt to track down and apprehend an active serial killer in the city. Karen, meanwhile, is out on the street. She's waiting for Eddie to call her on a payphone. And this is our first glimpse of the ubiquitous smiley face sticker. She's supposed to be transmitting her location to the police, but there's too much interference from the neon signs in the neighborhood. Oh, 1980s technology. And she's completely on her own. So this sets up a lot of tension because we know that they can't hear her and they don't know where she is. But she has no idea that she's basically in this alone. A patrol car is looking out for her. One of her fellow anchors is practicing his report in the mirror. And we learn that Eddie had contacted her and set this all in motion.
Can I say, this is one of my favorite parts, because the actor, when he's rehearsing in the mirror, he's got that, you know, deep sonorous voice with no accent. He's got the news anchor stereotypical voice. But when Bill comes in and he starts chatting with him, he's got this soft, deeply Southern accent.
Aha, and, Bill.
Yeah. And it's hilarious. And it lends this sense of unreality where you immediately think, oh, nothing in this movie is as it seems. But it also comes back into play at the very end, and it pays off in this amazing gag. And it's just, it's such smart storytelling, but it's also perfect humor dropped in the middle of this really tense scene with Dee Wallace's character. I love that part.
Yeah, me too.
So the payphone rings and it's Eddie, but they, like I said, can't hear him, so they don't know what's going on. And Eddie's clearly getting off on this call to Karen. He asks if she's wearing what he asked her to wear before she ends the call and just says, I'll be there soon. As you mentioned, Jessica, this is where we see Roger Corman.
Roger Corman.
Waiting to use the phone booth after Karen. And he checks the phone for change.
True to Corman's nature.
That was one of those things when I was a kid. I was like, why are they holding on this random guy for so long? I never understood. Because on the old pan and scan version, you couldn't really see him checking for the coins. And so now that I know the joke, it's like, I love it. But when I first saw it, it's like, okay. Like, were they just waiting for the reel to run out?
I guess it's going to come up later. She ends up in this grimy, red-lit porn shop. And Dee Wallace herself was actually really uncomfortable being in this store. And that look on her face is not her acting. That's genuine discomfort. She thinks everything's still going according to plan. They know where she is. So she ends up in a private booth, replete with a smiley face sticker on the door. The lighting in this scene is incredible.
My notes just say, my God, the lighting in the booth. It's gorgeous. All the lighting on Karen. She has this, we kind of see her as Eddie sees her in a way. She's always kind of glittering and glowing from within every time she's lit. I'm obsessed with the lighting in this movie.
He's in the shadows behind and he puts his hand on her shoulder. And the only light that seems to be on her face is coming from the porno that's playing on the screen in front of her. And Eddie is so creepy as he makes her watch this scene play on the screen in front of her. And he tells her that he watches her on TV. He's going to light up her whole body, as Brian already imitated. And then he tells her in this more growly voice, turn around now, Karen. She turns around, but we still don't see Eddie. He's still in the shadows and the camera light just shines behind him. So he's like kind of hidden by that. Police have arrived and they're talking to the proprietor who says, yeah, she's here. She cleared the place out. He's actually mad that he let that broad come in.
Which it's kind of sad, but it's also kind of hilarious. Every time she comes across a male customer before she goes into the booth with Eddie, they give her a double take and run out as fast as they can. Yes. Like all these men in the sex shop who are terrified of an actual woman.
Yeah.
She does get enough of a glimpse of Eddie to start to freak out, and Eddie begins to attack. Police hear her scream. They rush to the booth, and one of them shoots Eddie. So Karen's hunky husband, Bill, shows up with their friend and colleague, Chris, who's played by Dennis Dugan. And Chris wants her to go on air to talk about what happened. And she's like, I don't know what happened. I don't remember what happened. And she starts to suffer from PTSD, basically.
It's a really good depiction of PTSD, like the loss of memory and the trauma and all of the emotional problems and intimacy problems she has. It's really spot on. And Dee Wallace does such an amazing job of capturing her trauma and her vulnerability and just how she's been affected by it. I've rewatching it, I was struck by how good her performance was and how well she got into the character. I love Dee Wallace, but it's such a good depiction of trauma.
It really is. And it's probably before, you know, were they even calling it PTSD at this point? Probably not, mm-hmm. as I recall, but it really is a remarkable performance and authentic to all of these things. She's just so good in everything. My God.
She is. She is. But yeah, it's such a good understanding of what it feels like to have memories blocked out to kind of protect yourself or to go through something so traumatic mm-hmm. that you just have no clue what happened or who you were in that moment. It's such a good, you know, you wouldn't expect possibly a werewolf movie to be a really sensitive exploration of mental health, but it absolutely is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of psychological interest going on in this movie.
Oh, and yeah.
It tries to betray everything in an authentic way, even in, you know, the werewolves themselves.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it's all very fascinating. And, yeah. And, you know, then that's, I think that really comes from John Sayles. It seems like he was really interested in psychology and sort of these psychoanalysis groups and things like that, that were, and self-help gurus and things like that, but also wedding that with real traumas and how people deal with them. It's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And even Eddie's character to me is so fascinating. Like there's clearly been so much thought put into him, because as we'll see, his drawings and the clippings and the things that he's fascinated with that he keeps around him. I mean, we'll get to it in a second, but Eddie is such a fascinating character, and he's really magnetic, even though he's a terrifying person. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really, really compelling combination of, you know, horror and pathos and sex, because obviously there's a lot of sex in this movie, and it's just a really interesting combination of the dangerous side of that, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Eddie's not in it for that much of the movie, like for such a dominant character. He's really, I mean, he's, I don't know, probably in it for what, like 5-10 minutes in total?
Yeah, but he really does have some of the most impactful scenes, not just on the viewer, but also on our protagonist, on Karen.
Absolutely.
But yeah, but he does, you know, he's got the iconic transition scene. Mm-hmm. He's got that amazing scene in the booth where we kind of get how we get his level of obsession and how there's a level of menace, but it's also, there's a little bit about it that's a little erotic, even though it's, there are really horrific things going on and there's a threat of violence the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he casts a long shadow, even though you're right, he doesn't have a lot of screen time.
So Chris and his girlfriend, Terry, played by Belinda Belaski, show up at Eddie's apartment, and it is your typical serial killer kind of hovel. There's news clippings about the murders and other things all over the wall, as well as all these drawings of wolves.
Yeah, and that character name, Terry, is, her name is Terry Fisher, as in Terrence Fisher, the director of Curse of the Werewolf.
Mm-hmm.
So famous Hammer director, you know, sort of one of the most, probably the most prolific one. And there's another, I'll wait and see if you touch on the other Hammer director that comes up in this as well.
I don't think I do. I did have notes about all the different like names, like, but in reference to directors of werewolf movies, but I think I took them all out because there were so many.
Yeah. The other one is Freddie Francis, the sort of the guy that runs the news. They're, I guess, the head of the news department. His name is Freddie Francis. Anyway.
Terry is startled by a snarling dog at the window, but she throws something while yelling at it. Yeah. Terry's pretty tough. Like, she's probably one of my favorite characters in the movie. She gets a raw deal, I think.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
And they find a drawing of Karen. Terry's line about how he could have designed the Marquis de Sade coloring book. I mean, Eddie, like, adult coloring books are a big thing right now. So Eddie in the 2000s could have had a big, like, career as a coloring book designer. And then they find this charcoal landscape drawing, and Terry wonders if it's based on a real place. They take what they find to Dr. Wagner. He gives them some insight into Eddie's brain. He talks about how Eddie is controlled by the right side of the brain, the artistic, creative side, he says. Terry and Chris are trying to get a 30-minute special all about the mind of Eddie Quist, and now they would get a Netflix miniseries about him. But it's time for Karen to go back on the air. We're going to be making ratings history tonight, her producer says. They refer to him as Eddie the Mangler, which I think is a great name for a wrestler.
Yeah.
They go on air, and Karen starts to see Eddie in all the cameras and the lights, and she freezes. The producer gets mad and makes the comment, which makes me so angry. Who knows? Maybe she's pregnant.
Right. Yeah, that's Freddie Francis.
That's Freddie Francis. Nice. Yeah.
It's like, now there's a professional. And has himself on the screen.
Right. And can we just give a shout out to Kevin McCarthy, who is the master of Smarm? He's such a good performer, and I'm kind of obsessed with how he kind of morphed into, in the 80s, just the ultimate asshole, to be frank. And he's so good at that role.
Mm-hmm.
He's funny, but yeah, he's definitely an asshole, but funny in the process.
Yes. I love Kevin McCarthy so much. Yeah.
Karen goes to see Dr. Wagner. She still can't remember anything that happened. She only has these little flashes in her dreams, and she has these dreams throughout the movie that kind of morph into other things. He recommends that she go to the colony for a few weeks to try and recover, recharge her batteries. Why does he send her there?
Wagner is such a weird character to me. He seems so contradictory because he's like, oh, you're going to be safe. Well, he knows that he's literally sending her into a den of wolves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he's like, has he just fooled himself to believe, oh, I have them under control? And I don't know.
The only thing that makes sense is that he wants to turn her, because why would you send someone so high profile in the middle of a case about, you know, someone trying to kill her to her inevitable death? The only thing that makes sense to me is that he wants to turn her, I guess, just to have more powerful people kind of under his thumb a bit.
Yeah, it seems weird to me though, because he's the one that wants them to kind of hide and like we talked about earlier, repress their true natures. So he sends this TV anchor who has like journalists as friends to the colony
who are already nosing around and asking a lot of questions. Yeah.
It's a weird situation, but they go up there, Karen and Bill, despite her misgivings. She's like, I'm not sure I want to remember. She's also worried that they might be a bunch of weirdos. Oh, honey, if only
cut to the weirdos. That's an amazing. I hope these people aren't too weird. Oh. Oh,
yeah. That's one of my favorite cuts.
It is perfection.
Any movie where John Carradine just literally howling in front of the fire is just so great. And I just adore John Carradine in this movie.
Oh, he's so good.
So funny.
It actually looks like a good time. They're having this beach barbecue. They're cooking prime rib over a fire. But we learn that Bill won't partake as he's a vegetarian. And he kind of tries to stay away from meat, which he references a few times. There's a reason.
Right.
And a lot of folks recognize Karen. She's kind of a big deal. Earl, played by John Carradine, not enjoying the party at all. Like, I'm guessing when he says his teeth are shot, like, he can't eat the meat properly. So, like, right. he's right. not enjoying that. We next meet the sultry Marcia, who looks like she should be in an 80s metal video.
I think yeah. she looks like she should be in, like, a Conan the Barbarian movie or something. Like, she's wearing a lot of furs, mm-hmm. and she looks kind of, got a bit of a medieval look to her.
Yeah, with that woven band around her head.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but she has one of the best line deliveries in the movie when Bill kind of gets separated from Karen, and he walks up to Marcia, and he says, "I'm looking for my wife," and she waits a beat and says, "Why?"
Why?
it's so good.
Oh yeah.
Marcia is one of the best female villains mm-hmm. in horror of the 80s. I wish that Howling 2 had taken over from where Howling 1 ends, just to see her really have a movie, you mm-hmm. know. I know they did the whole Sybil Danning thing, and you know that okay, she's lovely, but in her own way. But I think for the story, I think having Marcia Quist as she appears at the end of the movie just go on from there would have been amazing, because mm-hmm. that character is just, I wish she was explored more, you know, because she's only in a little bit of the movie, but she's so memorable, and so she's just got a presence to her mm-hmm. that is so fascinating but scary, and she's gorgeous, my god.
Yeah, you can see why Bill is drawn to her. I'm not obviously yeah. I'm not condoning infidelity, but you can see why he's drawn to her, because she's just yeah. she has such a presence. Like, I would be drawn to her at a bonfire. I would walk up to her and yeah. say, "I'm looking for my wife."
And she makes her intentions known pretty quickly.
Oh, yes, she does.
With that absolutely. Why line, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is not timid in the slightest. She lets him mm-hmm. know right away.
Meanwhile, Karen is talking with Dr. Wagner, and they are interrupted by Marcia, who gives the doctor his book, saying she doesn't want her brother reading it. He's done enough damage already. So already we get this kind of idea that there's some tension at the colony. One of the other characters, Donna, describes Marcia as a very elemental and a nymphomaniac. And most of the people at the colony seem very, you know, kind of your average American, probably middle class citizen. They're just like, you know, they're just trying to find themselves and better themselves. So Marcia and her brother TC really kind of stand out from this.
They're the ones that seem most in touch with the wolf.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely.
With this id personality.
Yes.
And Marcia especially is just like, just wants to embrace it entirely.
Mm-hmm.
She, I don't, it's weird, you know, why is she connected with this guy, with this colony at all? Mm-hmm. Because she has such opposing views clearly to him.
Yeah.
And while where the others seem to kind of be buying into it, it's like, okay, in order to survive, we gotta keep this at bay and all these sorts of things. And it's almost like she's just there. She and her brother are just there because to avoid the risk of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think that's one reason Marcia is such a fascinating character, because she is the most in tune. Like, she doesn't have that internal war. She's very much combined these two sides of herself. She's, even when she's not in a wolf form, she's still a wolf. Like, if you saw mm-hmm. this woman on the street, you would probably think she was a werewolf, because that she's just kind of, you know, made it a part of herself. If either one of you has seen Glow, she's is it Sheila? Mm-hmm. She's kind of like Sheila in that, you know, it's not a costume, that's just who she is. And
right,
yeah, I mm-hmm. think that's one reason that we're so drawn to her, because I personally envy people who are that self-actualized, to use a psychology term, you yeah. know, who are so in tune with themselves and who yeah. they really are. So I think there's a bit of envy there, that she's so, you know, comfortable with herself.
Absolutely. And I think actually it's funny that you said that she's so self-actualized, because that's exactly what I was thinking. Like, you compare her to Donna, who goes through all of these different self-help and like cult-like mm-hmm. organizations to try and become, as she says, a full human being. And then mm-hmm. she sees somebody like Marcia, who is 100% self-actualized. She's going to be jealous, right?
Yeah. And Karen gravitates to Donna because she sees Donna as the most normal person, even though by her own admission, Donna has the most trouble with her own self and with her mm-hmm. identity. Like mm-hmm. she has a lot of problems in the context of this psychological commune of kind of getting in touch with her real self and figuring herself out. But Kieran sees her as the normal one and she sees Marcia as the weird one, which there's a lot of judgment going on there and a lot of, you know, commentary on how we view people who are in touch with themselves when we don't necessarily approve of what that self is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We see that there's more dissension or more turmoil in the group when Earl tries to throw himself into the bonfire and he just wants to end it. He says it just goes on and on. But Charlie and the doctor intervene and pull him away. Karen's plagued by more nightmares that night, but now they're about Earl and his agony. She wakes up. She hears this howling. She looks out the window to see something in the woods by their cabin. Bill dismisses her concerns. He's like, it's the wind or someone's dog. And you were raised in LA. The wildest thing you ever heard was Wolfman Jack.
Yep.
He goes back to sleep. She stays awake. She's tending the fireplace. And we get a wolf's eye view as something approaches the cabin. And in my head, I'm like, don't leave the cabin, Karen. Don't leave the cabin. But of course, she does. She at least has a flashlight as she scans the woods, but she doesn't see a thing. However, we see TC creeping in the woods watching her.
They make really good use of kind of the wolf POV, not quite the killer POV, but I love the wolf POV in some of the shots. And not to harp on the lighting too much, I could spend an hour just talking about the lighting, but when they're in the forest in the moonlight, it's just gorgeous. The way, like, the woods come alive in this movie, like the fog and the light that's filtering in through the trees. There's so much menace just in the way they shot it, and it's really fantastic. Mm-hmm.
As I recall, and I know there's also wolf POV in Wolfen, but it's like, this weird filter.
Yeah.
Have either of you seen that?
Yes.
I just watched it this week, actually. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I commented on that. Yeah. And so that has that wolf POV too. Doesn't American Werewolf in London does too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just kind of interesting that, you know, quote, killer POV is happening in all three of these werewolf movies too. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of, that was the thing, you know, to do at that time, it seems like. And this was early in the 80s, so it hadn't become so much of a cliche necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That it was still effective in all three films, which all three do it in a different way.
Yeah, like Wolfen has, like you said, the kind of like a filter. It's kind of like a heat filter.
A heat filter. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The next morning, Karen is playing tennis with her new friend, Donna, and the sheriff shows up because she called him about something in the woods. And he's like, oh, there's been coyotes in the area. That's nothing to worry about. And as, of course, as like a born and bred city girl, I'm like, there's coyotes in the area. Why? Like, no, that's something to worry about. Chris and Terry are still working on their investigation, and they go and visit the morgue, where they meet the morgue attendant, who is played by the uncredited John Sayles.
Mm-hmm.
And he apparently had actually worked in postmortem care before he became a screenwriter.
I got to just read a biography or something on John Sayles, because I swear that guy must be one of the most interesting people. I hear all these things about him and like, man, this guy, there's just so much interesting stuff with this guy in how he makes movies and how he wrote and writes. And, the acting stuff he did, the stuff he did before that, it's just fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The shot where there are removed organs next to the morgue attendant's lunch is both hysterical and gross. And apparently that came from his experience in postmortem care. Eddie's body is missing and the mystery deepens. He says he didn't get up and walk out on his own. Actually, that's exactly what he did.
Right.
And that great shot from inside the tray, I'm not sure what the terminology is for where the body is stored, but the body bag is all slashed and the inside of the door is completely slashed from clearly very powerful claws. It's such a creepy, mysterious, well, not that mysterious, but mysterious to the characters at that moment, but it's such a creepy shot.
Also, like, why that doesn't tip anybody off to be like,
Yeah, they don't. The morgue attendant doesn't seem all that curious, though. No. I'm sure he's seen some stuff in his lifetime.
That's true. So. That's true. Donna and Karen are new besties. They're hanging out that night. They're listening to cows that don't sound quite right, they say. So they're like, Jerry's got a rifle. Let's go grab that. So they start walking through the misty woods. And Donna starts telling Karen all about her self-help journey. And then they come upon a bull carcass. just in time for Karen's flashlight to die. What does Donna think shaking the flashlight is going to do? She grabs the flashlight and she starts shaking it. And she's like, I know about batteries.
I always see that happen in movies, but I've never actually tried that myself. Maybe it works. I don't know.
Maybe.
You know, when I was in I was in Boy Scouts as a kid. And so, you know, you could like sort of hit your flashlight against your hand when the batteries got really, really low. And it would just sort of like knock them and just like make a little bit of shine come out sometimes. Not very often, but.
Yeah. The ranchers show up and they confirm that it wasn't coyotes that did this. Maybe now's the time to go back to Los Angeles and barricade yourself in your house. I'm just saying. But no, Jerry's going to teach Bill how to shoot so they can go on a wolf hunt with TC as their bloodhound.
Have you met the boys?
Boys part bloodhound.
Yeah. And that really goes back to like what we were talking about with Marcia and TC being the most in touch with their like werewolf side or their wolf side. Mm-hmm. It's like TC is the one that can like track the wolves.
And he even moves like an animal. He's not walking, you know, upright like a quote-unquote normal person. He's kind of like prowling like an animal.
It's like he's spent more time as a wolf than as a human. And so when he's in his human form, he doesn't really entirely know what to do with himself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
And we see that later in the movie when he's coming out of the barn towards Chris and he walks again, kind of more like he's an animal, not so human. Mm-hmm. They don't find any wolves, but Bill does end up killing a rabbit. And later on, TC tells him, well, you have to eat the rabbit. Like, it's a sin to not eat the rabbit. And he's like, you should take it to my sister. She'll cook it up for you. Prior to that, however, Karen is in group therapy. And Dr. Wagner's, again, trying to get her to remember what happened. She still can't see what happened. She still can't remember. She's still having brief flashbacks, but can't put it all together. We transition back to LA. Two nuns enter an occult bookstore, which sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. And continuing.
They just stared at that bust of the devil.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of grinning at it.
Yeah.
Right. Those were some pretty hip nuns. I kind of liked them. Even though Dick Miller was not a fan of those two nuns.
Well, he was like, get all kinds in here. Sun worshippers, moon worshippers, Satanists.
The man since he used to shoplift. Bunch of deadbeats.
He's so good in this. Oh.
I have something to say. This was Dick Miller's favorite role.
Really?
Was this one as Walter Paisley, this version of Walter Paisley, which is a running joke, of course, in The Howling. Because it is just like a day job, too. You know, it was one day and it's his favorite role. It was his favorite role, he said. And I love that because at first he didn't really get it. And then Joe Dante is just saying, well, just be yourself. And it's like, oh, okay. And it's perfect. It's just, this was for me, I am sure I'd seen Gremlins first, but this was the movie that made me sit up and go, this guy's interesting, you know, because, and really seek out, you know, Dick Miller as an actor and want to see stuff he was in was The Howling.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite actors. He is amazing. Yeah. I was talking about him, I think, on another podcast, and he's got a Harry Dean Stanton quality to him where he's so naturalistic and does such a good everyman that sometimes it feels like he plays himself in every role, but I think it's just because he's such a good actor, he makes it look easy. Like, obviously, you just said that he's kind of playing himself in this one, but he still brings, like, such a presence and such an amazing talent that I'm just entranced every time he's on screen. He's so good.
I definitely didn't mean that in a disparaging
way,
he's so great in everything, and just his, like you said, his presence is so it's just so alive and energetic, and yet every movie, even like the early Corman movies, I mean, he looks like he's 53 years old.
Yeah, even when he's 22. Yeah.
He's just got that quality about him, you know, sort of this world weary guy.
Exactly. Yeah. He inhabits these characters, and you feel like you know about the past 20 years of this person's life, even if he's on screen for like 2 seconds. It's amazing.
Yeah.
He's got such great lines. Like when he says that, like when they're talking to him about werewolves, and he's like, oh, they're shapeshifters. But he's like, silver or fire will kill them. Anything else, they may look dead, but they're not. And when he's like, they're worse than cockroaches.
Yeah, I love that. The way he says that word. He says it cockroaches.
Cockroaches,
yes.
I love that. Mm-hmm. It's just those little details in performance that are exactly. so memorable that just, I mean, because another actor might have just said it, they're worse than cockroaches, which would have been fine. But to say, the way he says it, cockroaches,
yeah.
is just like, it's so memorable.
Yeah. And the way he rolls his eyes at the nuns, and at the very end of that scene where they're looking through the book that's supposed to be really creepy and ominous with these illustrations of mm-hmm. werewolves, and he's still being the consummate salesman. He says, that's a good book. And then that's the end of the scene. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And he's also like, I think he talks about how he doesn't believe this stuff. Like he's, right. he's just selling it. Like it's mm-hmm. not.
It's like, I'm trying to make a buck here. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Which we later see when he gets mad at somebody for flipping through things. He's like, you're going to get them all dirty.
Yeah. There's our Forrest J. Ackerman cameo.
Yes.
Ackerman, yeah. Yeah. And it turns around. He's got the famous Monsters of Filmland mm-hmm. in his hand. How I missed that the first million times I watched the movie. I have no idea.
Yeah. I didn't know who Ackerman was. Again, it was one of those things. I didn't know. I learned who he was around the same time I learned who Corman was. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things where when I was first seeing this, I didn't catch those things either.
Right. But
then it was like, oh. Yeah. These great things, great moments.
Absolutely. Oh, and another cut, like the editing in this is so brilliant. We go immediately from that image of the big bad wolf in Little Red Riding Hood in the book that they're looking mm-hmm. at, the one that Dick Miller's like, that's a good book. We go immediately from that image to TC in his fur vest, mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. wolf to a wolf. It's just, yeah. it's such smart filmmaking.
Yes. And that's when he tells Bill that, you know, Marsha will cook that up for you. Your wife might like it. But Marsha is not dressed for cooking. She plans on cooking it later.
She's dressed for cooking, all right. He's just not cooking rabbit.
Oh, I put she wants another hot dish, Bill.
Oh, nice.
Oh.
He rebuffs her advances this time. And as he's walking through the woods back to his cabin, he is attacked by a giant wolf. Which wolf do you think this is? Do you think it's Marsha?
Marsha. I'm certain it's Marsha.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah, and we've got that really creepy close-up of the wolf's eye, like, because she's been watching him the whole movie. I think mm-hmm. that's kind of hinting that, you know, Marsha's been watching him the whole movie, and now she's watching him again as a wolf. So I'd say Marsha.
He manages to get back to the cabin and is treated by Dr. Wagner. Dr. Wagner's like, oh, don't travel, like, right now. It's risky. But Karen says she wants to go home. And Terry and Chris are watching a werewolf movie in bed when they're interrupted by a call from Karen. And she's like, Bill's been bitten. So, and Terry is such a great friend. She's like, you know what? I'll be right there. I'm going to come and like, we will be there and help you out.
And she has such a good line delivery here too. Like they've been watching the wolf man in bed and they're talking about how, you know, unbelievable it is that werewolves could be real. And then when she talks to Karen on the phone and then looks over at Chris, she says, Bill was bitten by a wolf. Can you believe it? You know, the way she delivers it is so funny, but it's also like it mm-hmm. sets up this really creepy yeah. sequence.
Then it goes to the whole, you know, whoever is yes. bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself. You know, I mean, that's mm-hmm. it's the whole, you know, it's the meta thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people talk about how, say, you know, Scream, you know, was so revolutionary. And it was, of course it was. But there had been actually quite a bit of meta stuff before that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
This being one of them, because this is an example of a werewolf movie in which people watch werewolf yeah. movies.
Yeah.
And I really like that it's doing that in such a fun way, you know?
Yeah, like bringing in like the cartoons. Like I think there's a Disney, you know, Big Bad Wolf cartoon or... Mm-hmm. And, yeah. you know, they got their money's worth on the Wolfman because, you know, before the MCU made it cool, there's a post-credit scene where they have another clip from the Wolfman at the very end of the film. If you stay through the end of the credits of The Howling, like they definitely got their money's worth for mm-hmm. the Wolfman. And I love that, you know, drawing from such a classic and using some of these lines to kind of bring some humor into it, but also underscore how serious the situation is.
Yeah.
The first thing the four friends do when they are reunited is they have a little beach picnic. And this is where we start to suspect that something is wrong with Bill when Terry's like, oh, the veggies. I forgot. I'm sorry, Bill. And he's like, ah, this is really good. And he's chowing down on like what looks like a chicken leg.
Right. He's really going for it. into that.
And sign number two, he is reading in bed and he recoils a little from Karen's affection.
Yeah. And I want to say, like, earlier in an earlier scene, when Bill tries to initiate sex with her, she doesn't want to because she's still, you know, quite traumatized and sexually traumatized from, you know, being in the porn theater and watching this horrific scene play out and being kind of menaced by Eddie in a way that had a threat of sexual violence, which ties in a lot with what we were talking about with PTSD. And now he is not interested in sex and how out of sync they are and just how PTSD can affect interpersonal relationships and sexual relationships. So I like that they're kind of using that as a through line through the movie.
Yeah.
The whole depiction of their relationship and the way it devolves is it's so heartbreaking because they start out and like, you know, he's very concerned about her. He's not like they just seem to have a very good, solid relationship at the beginning. Not that you get a lot of insight into it, but you really see it just kind of fall apart throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, even before, like, even before he has his moment in the rabbit soup shack with Marcia, like, even from the moment he sees her, he has a conversation. The rabbit shack. Tin roof rusted. Karen hears the howling outside and he tells her, oh, it's just your imagination. No, you don't know what you're talking about. He's dismissing her so much and being kind of cruel because she's still really sensitive to, you know, scary noises and loud noises. She's still, you know, suffering from, you know, trauma and shock. And he's really dismissing her and being kind of cruel to her. So it's already, even before anything happens with Bill physically, before he's bitten by a werewolf, before anything happens physically with Marcia, just being in the colony, things are falling apart for her and for them.
Karen has more nightmares, but this time she wakes up alone in bed and she is not impressed, which she shouldn't be because Bill is meeting up with Marcia outside and it's time for a little bonfire tryst. And there's this chorus of wolves howling. It wakes Terry up. So being a good investigator, she gets out her recorder and records it. Back at the campfire, Bill and Marcia are getting primal and they are starting to transform into werewolves as they are having sex. So the cartoon animation where they're making love as werewolves was done because of budgetary reasons.
Yeah, but before the animation sequence, it's really, I think it's really captivating, like seeing them kind of half human, half wolf as they give into their quote unquote animal instincts as they're, you know, having sex and, you know, they're snarling and they've got fangs and he's drooling. Like he's really giving into, you know, I'm not trying to buy into the idea that, you know, having sex is lesser or animalistic, but he's giving in his base instincts. So to quote the doctor, probably. So I really like that kind of mid transformation. I can understand why they may have not have been as happy with the animation part, which is probably why it cuts away rather quickly. But I like the halfway point where they're kind of, you know, Marcia's giving into her animal side and getting Bill to go along with it. Not that he's putting out much of a fight, but
no.
And it does cut away from the animation quite quickly with a shot of the full moon. We still hear the werewolves howling and that transitions beautifully into the next scene where Terry is sitting on the beach and she's playing back her recording of the wolves howling. So that landscape drawing earlier in the film, Terry's right there and she has a keen eye and realizes, hey, this is what was in Eddie's room. This is the landscape drawing that he had done. She's walking back through the woods. All of a sudden, they get misty and she hears someone calling her name. Just get out of the forest, Terry.
It's terrifying. It like is. They're so good at combining the humor and the horror because this moment in the woods with someone whispering for her is just, God. And with the, like I keep saying, the woods are come alive with this light coming in and the fog rolling in. It's just terrifying.
Yeah, when it's like, over here, Terry.
Right.
Yeah.
And she goes in because she's obviously a journalist. She's very curious. She goes to investigate instead of running for her life like I would. But
yeah. She comes upon a cabin in the woods. It is decked out in animal skins and bone. Very, as we talked about, Texas Chainsaw Massacre-y vibes. There's a slightly ajar door. So, of course, she goes in because that's what you do. Like, Terry, you're trespassing. Werewolves do not appreciate that kind of shenanigan. but there is still a werewolf stalking her outside, so I guess, you know, she gets a pass. She finds a charcoal drawing similar to the one she found in Eddie's apartment before seeing that damn smiley face sticker on a door.
Right? Which I can't help, but that made me, I obviously, this predates Watchmen, but it made me think of Watchmen quite a bit. And it just ties back in with the combination of, you know, it's a funny thing that it's humorous, but it's also really, really creepy, which is perfect for Eddie's whole vibe. Like that this is his calling card, that he wants to unsettle people and kind of not to make an American Werewolf pun, but he wants to unmoor people and catch them off balance. So
entering the room, she finds that it's the rustic version of Eddie's LA apartment, and she hears something outside, so she escapes out the window and hides under the porch. She's smart though. And she grabs an axe. She still gets grabbed from behind and she fights back. She severs one of the werewolf's limbs. And this is so gross when it continues to pulsate and it turns back into a human hand quite slowly. Like it is a process.
It is. And it's one of my favorite effect sequences. It's so cool. Like you're right. It's disgusting. Like all the werewolf transformations are disgusting and like really draw attention to how painful this must be. Mm-hmm. Like all the horrible things that the body goes through. We'll get to it in a minute with that amazing on-screen transformation. But I love that effect as the werewolf paw and arm turns into a human arm with these air bladders that Rob Bottin was so good at, as it kind of like pulses and oozes and it's, oh God, it's so good. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a little, I'm not making any sense anymore because I'm just like, oh, Rob Bottin. So...
Yeah, it's incredible. So she starts running through the woods. And one thing I always wonder when people are running through the woods, particularly in a horror movie, how do you know where to go?
Honestly, she's probably thinking anywhere but here works.
That's true. So, however, she ends up in a bad spot.
yeah, exactly. But I do want to draw attention to the sound design too. The howling noise that she hears when she chops through that werewolf arm. Mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated by the combination of sounds that sound designers do, especially for animal, like roars or, you know, pain or things like that. And it's really terrifying, but it's also a little bit sad because it makes you really feel for this creature that is in pain. Yeah. But it's really remarkable.
She ends up at Doc's and she manages to call Chris. She doesn't say, come help me. She says, you're not going to believe this. And there's a little scene, like a little shot that I don't quite understand. We see a wolf paw press a button on a tape recorder. And I'm not quite sure why.
I think it's because Eddie wanted audio of Terry dying.
He
enjoys women being in pain. That's like, true. You know, the video that he made Karen watch at the beginning. I mean, he's been killing women, you know, in the city. He likes women being in pain. And he has a lot of the stuff in his, like the Marquis de Sade line, like he enjoys seeing women in bondage and doing things against their will. So he just wanted audio of Terry in pain because that's how he gets off, to be frank.
Karen wakes up from another dream. She was apparently having an afternoon nap and she sees Bill transforming. Sorry, in her dream, she sees Bill transforming and he comes to check on her. She notices his sex scars on his back and he's like, oh, it must have been from when I was attacked. And she's like, no, they weren't there the other night. So they get into a fight. Bill ends up just backhanding her across the face, which is one of the hardest parts to watch in the movie, which I mean... is odd because there are werewolves rampaging, but
yeah, but it is hard. Like at first he tells her she's paranoid, she's imagining things, he starts gaslighting her, and then he just assaults her. He just hits her as hard as he can, and you know, not that it would be horrible in any situation, but especially someone who's already traumatized, mm-hmm. the fact that he's willingly re-traumatizing her while she's in such a precarious place.
Right.
It's just, and the way she reacts, like her physical fear of him and kind of curling up into herself to protect her body and to protect herself from him is just, oh, you feel for Karen and for Dee Wallace so much in that scene.
Terry tells Chris everything that she's seen. They're still on the phone. She says, I believe that Eddie is alive. And she's kind of onto the whole thing. She kind of gets everything that's going on. She thinks that the doc is involved in all of this. So Chris tells her, go through the filing cabinet and find the files under Quist. And she's doing this. He's watching cartoons. Big Bad Wolf cartoons, to be precise. Mm-hmm. She locates the files, but the werewolf shows up and takes it out of her hands. Chris can hear her screaming and the wolf growling. He calls the police. They call Sam, the police officer in the colony's geographical area.
The great Slim Pickens.
Yes. And he says, don't worry, I'm sure she's safe. Just as we see Eddie holding her up. Is it Eddie or is it TC? No, this is Eddie, I think.
This is Eddie.
Yeah, because TC was the other one in Eddie's cabin, right?
Right, who got his arm chopped off.
Yes, because we see later on he holds up his stump.
Mm-hmm,
And Eddie's holding her up by the neck before he kills her. And blood drips onto Eddie's vial. Poor Terry.
I know. It's a really horrific kill.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, you combine the horror of being attacked by this really powerful animal, but also knowing that he's getting a lot of pleasure from the sadism of it, from mm-hmm. inflicting pain on her, because he's still very much in control of his human side of the, you know, like we talked about with Marcia, you know, the Quist family, they're all kind of self-actualized as these brutal werewolves. Like he's very much, he's got his animal side, but his human brain is in control and is enjoying every second of kind of ripping Terry apart, which just makes it all the more horrifying.
Chris returns to the occult shop and he grabs some silver bullets. And again, the owner is hilarious. He's like, those are pure silver. I got to consult with a jeweler to see how much to charge. Pure salesman. He is.
It's fantastic.
Karen shows up at the doctor's office to find her dead friend. And like, Terry has just been savaged. Her throat has basically been ripped out. Karen covers her face with a sheet before heading to the phone. And for some reason, she backs away from the phone into the gurney where Eddie has somehow quietly removed Terry's body and positioned himself in her place. Like very quickly.
Yeah. It's the animal speed. We'll say that. Yeah. We'll chalk it up to that.
Yes. He's glad she came, he tells her. And when he says, I want to give you a piece of my mind, and he digs the bullet very painfully out of his forehead, I died. I absolutely died. Now, apparently, Robert Picardo improvised that line. That was not scripted. They were like, just say something. And he was like, okay.
Amazing.
You're back.
Maybe. A guest has arrived. It's like Host.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. I'll go get some salt and put a circle around my laptop.
So he starts to transform and it looks so painful. His skin bulges and throbs. His finger extends. Literally everything about the transformation looks absolutely agonizing.
It does. That's one of my favorite parts about it, that they emphasize just how excruciating it must be. You can hear the tendons snapping and the bones breaking mm-hmm. and the skin stretching past what the human body should be able to take. And there's so much blood, especially on his fingers. And it's just, it's fantastic. I said I'm a huge fan of werewolf movies, so I really geek out on screen transformations. Even terrible transformations I love, but this one is incredible. And I like the ones that emphasize what the body actually goes through to get from the human form to the wolf form, and this one is just amazing.
Another thing that I find interesting, though, yes, it seems like it's painful and everything, but to me it always seems like Eddie is kind of into it.
Oh, 100%.
You know,
yeah, we were just talking about how he's into pain. He's not just into other people's pain. He's into his own pain as well.
Yeah, because he's just kind of getting off on it. And a little bit also in the transformation with by the fire earlier as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like this pain and pleasure complex happening all at once.
Yeah, absolutely. Like this movie really kind of delves into, I don't want to seem like I'm passing judgment because I'm not at all, but the kind of the darker side of sex, because mm-hmm. there are parts of this movie that are really sexy and are really erotic. And you might not consider yourself someone who would find something like that sexy or erotic, but when you're watching it, you know, like there are parts when I will admit, I think Eddie is very sexy in some scenes, mm-hmm. maybe not necessarily when he's murdering people, but you know, they really kind of interrogate, like, you know, what perhaps Karen would see as normal, since she thinks Donna is normal and everybody else is weird. Mm-hmm. But it kind of looks at the line between, you know, well, here's what humans really like, and, you know, exploring the id and the animal nature, kind of blurring the lines between sex that's acceptable and sex that is pleasurable, if you allow yourself to think of it that way. I hope I'm not going too far for this podcast, but
yeah, like, I mean, when you think about the werewolf particularly as an expression of the id, and like the id is all about sex and violence, like mm-hmm. it makes sense, right? Like it's, but like, it's also not a fast process. Like the transformation takes a long time.
Yeah.
The movie's like, we're just going to, you know, let this play out. And even the music, like the music is throbbing while the transformation is happening as well. Mm-hmm. It's so well done. So now I have to ask the inevitable question, because they both came out in 1981, and we've talked about An American Werewolf in London a fair amount. Which transformation scene is better?
I haven't rewatched American Werewolf in London, and American Werewolf in London in a while, but as I recall, more of that happens on screen. Like it doesn't cut away as much, which I like.
Yeah.
I like that you see everything happen on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I might vote An American Werewolf in London for that reason, but I to go back to what we were talking about earlier, I think it's apples and oranges, even mm-hmm. though they're both on screen werewolf transformations. I think they're both kind of doing different things. So I'm too chicken to say definitively that one is better than the other.
And I've already said that this is my favorite werewolf movie,
mm-hmm.
but the transformation in American Werewolf in London is better. it's bright light. It's, you know, one of the things I do like in the performance though, here, is that Picardo is sort of doing the pain pleasure combo
mm-hmm.
in it. And that's happening in the makeup too, you know, like the change mm-hmm. heads and the stuff that he's not involved in mm-hmm. as well. There is sort of that. Whereas in American Werewolf, it's all pain.
Right.
It's all pain. It's all fear. Everything about it is terror.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here there's and I do like, you know, that everything's in the bright light. You actually see the hair grow. You actually see,
right.
I mean, there are things I know how they're done in American Werewolf, technically speaking,
mm-hmm.
because I've seen all the features on it and stuff like that, but I still find myself going, how, how did they make that happen still?
True.
And whereas this one, maybe I can see a little bit more that it's robotics and bladders and change of heads, mm-hmm. and which is all great and it's all revolutionary. I mean, you got to remember this came out before American Werewolf. So this was mm-hmm. in that few months between April and August, this was it. This was the definitive, you know, right. werewolf transformation movie, werewolf transformation scene. And it's pretty astonishing when you think mm-hmm. of it in that perspective. You know, and I love the wolves in this one, like the final werewolf. I think I prefer the final werewolf in The Howling to the one in American Werewolf, if I'm being honest. But I think the transformation is probably just that much more refined in Baker's hands than in Botine's.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Just because of a few years of experience on him. That's what I think it comes down to.
Yeah. If somebody asked me, show me one werewolf transformation on screen and impress me, I would show them an American Werewolf in London. So yeah, I'd have to agree with that.
Yeah. But God, I love this one too, though. Did we lose Sherry now?
I was going to say, Sherry?
Oh my gosh, I was muted.
When you were gone, something popped up that just said guest and there was no audio on my end. And I joked that it was like host. And then I thought, oh God, we're dropping like flies here. I spoke it into existence. I'm so sorry.
You're the Gemma.
Oh God. Sorry, Gemma.
There were times during shooting when Robert Picardo was actually very upset about the hours he had to spend in makeup to do really most of his scenes. And on the special edition DVD, he actually said, one day after spending 6.5 hours in the makeup chair, I was thinking, trained at Yale, 2 leading roles on Broadway, my first acting role in California, my face gets melted in a low budget horror movie. And all the crew had to say to that was, Bob, next time read the script all the way through first. I just love that.
Yeah.
This, however, the long transformation gives Karen the opportunity to grab a bottle of something behind her and throw it at him. And it's clearly acid or something because it burns.
Yeah. And I think one reason the transformation takes so long is because he's all about power and control. And he's kind of dragging it out intentionally to show his dominance over her. Because in other scenes, it doesn't take nearly as long to transform.
Oh, that's true.
I think he's really relishing having this, seeing the fear in her eyes and kind of drawing out this sense of controlling her that way.
Well, like you talked about, he likes to inflict pain and fear on women. And so that's that would definitely do it, right? Like just having this go on in front of her and just to see like the effects.
Yeah, it's the ultimate act of dominance, just making her watch it happen.
And from a filmmaking standpoint, it's just cool to see it. happen. Oh,
yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have that effect happening, you're gonna want to film it for an hour and just show that.
It's the first time this kind of thing is being seen. That's one of the things that is interesting to remember, because the one in American Werewolf is really long too.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of interesting because, you know, later it would get to be where werewolf transformations happen in, you know, seconds. You know, the guy just rips his skin off and all of a sudden he's a werewolf.
Yeah, but and then it's scarier when you linger on a scene and you don't cut away too fast or you don't do quick cuts. Like sometimes there's a place for that, but I'm a big fan of just letting things unfold and being patient with the scene, and it makes it that much scarier. I like my horror patient in that way, and they definitely, you know, let the audience take in the awfulness of what's happening.
Yeah, well said.
Chris is still rushing to get to Terry, not knowing that she is, of course, dead. And this is just such a little throwaway scene, but it's so funny when he stops for gas and he's honking at the guy in front of him. And the guy says, take it easy, pal. Not all of us have enough money for a Mazda.
I put that in my notes, too. Like, were Mazdas that pricey back then? I have no idea.
They must have been, like... Oh my gosh. Like, was it a luxury car?
That line cracks me up. It has always cracked. My first car was a Mazda, and it was like, it's like, it wasn't, I mean, that was, you know, the sport edition, I suppose, in that he's driving, but my gosh.
But there is a little bit of a class element, because like you mentioned, like some of these people, you know, clearly are quote unquote lower class compared to like, you know, Bill owns a chain of, you know, gyms or health store or health clubs. That's it. You know, and, you know, Karen's a successful journalist. And then she's kind of looking down at her nose at these people who just kind of live off the land. So I like that they throw in these little digs about, you know, working class versus kind of upper middle class people. And apparently those people have Mazdas.
Yeah, apparently. I think, you know, and I think that, Sales brings a lot of a hard-edged political cynicism to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's all through it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of really satirical elements in the humor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where it's I mean, especially when we're getting towards the ending, that where it just gets really just hard, jaded cynicism that's just shot all through this movie that I don't think is really there in American Werewolf. It's a little bit more young optimism, where this is a little bit more jaded, older, a little bit older people who are just cynical about everything.
Yeah, I'd agree with that 100%.
Back at the colony, Karen does not get very far because she is intercepted by Jerry and the cattle farmer, Charlie. They're all in on it, so they take her to this creepy-ass old barn where the members of the colony await, and there's more animal skins, more bones, just kind of lying around.
Very Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah, it is. It is. There's a body on the table. I'm guessing it's Terry. There's a head on a spike. Wagner comes in, and she's relieved. She runs to him.
Poor Karen.
Right? Before we learn that Terry was indeed onto something, and he is part of it all. In fact, he's running – well, we knew he was running the colony, but he's running the werewolf colony. Marcia's like, Bill is one of us now. And even seemingly normal Donna and her husband Jerry are part of it. Mm-hmm. So they talk about how she was supposed to be brought into the werewolf cult. If she accepts the gift, she can have Bill back, and the doctor can help her live her new wolfy life.
So, and that takes it back to what Jessica was saying at the beginning, that, you know,
that's true.
The reason why he wanted them to come out there was so that they could be turned. And, you know, even after however many viewings, that never really dawned on me, you know. But I definitely see that now in this, through this discussion.
Yeah. And I mean, the doctor, he's willingly doing a lot of television appearances talking about the gift. Like, no, the name of his book is The Gift, or Accepting the Gift. Yeah. But, and that's what he calls lycanthropy, is the gift. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of wanting to expand, because I mean, it is a cult. He might be just wanting to expand his power, like bring in more werewolves, because that gives him more power over people. And, you know, he's the leader of an LA cult. You know, obviously he's trying to put his, reach his tendrils out to as many areas as he can, you know, in news and entertainment and, you know, different, you know, established power that way.
Not everyone is happy with that idea, though. Jerry's like, we never should have brought her here. Earl thinks they should have stuck with the old ways. There is very high dissension in the ranks. So Earl's like, we should be preying on humans, not living like we're living. The doctor's like, the danger of exposure is what has been keeping them living like this. They need to be more modern werewolves, he says. Marcia, of course, is with Earl. She doesn't want to live with the humans, and she's decided that Karen is theirs now. And this is where we learn that TC was the one that attacked Terry. He shows off his new stump. Look what your friend did to me. And they start to fight back against the doctor. You can't tame what's meant to be wild, Doc. It ain't natural, Earl says. Chris, meanwhile, has arrived at the doctor's office, and he hears a recording play. It is the interview between the doctor and Terry, and Eddie shows up. He takes the gun from Chris and tells him that Terry is at the ritual center. If you have a ritual center,
you're in a cult.
You're in a cult, yeah.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite scenes when again, if this is too much information, I sincerely apologize.
No.
But this is the scene where I find Eddie really sexy, when he keeps calling Chris Bright Boy, and he just keeps like vaguely menacing him, but he's kind of also just, he really likes letting people know, finally, this is who I am. You know, I'm a werewolf. And he just keeps calling him Bright Boy and challenging him. And it's such a cool scene and so creepy in a way that I haven't quite figured out yet.
He's so
melted,
gnarly.
Melted
though.
Face, really.
It does, yeah. Like Toxic Avenger, sign me up.
Oh, okay. Just checking. Just checking. Make sure, you know. Hey, you do you. I actually really love the makeup in this sequence, because it's so crazy, because he's got that jawbone sticking out and stuff like that. And obviously, he's built onto the top of his face, but it somehow works. It doesn't, it doesn't look like it's built up too much and all sorts of things like that, you know, like sometimes can happen. And I just think, it's really impressive, how it all looks. And, you're right. He's just got a presence and he's got the animal magnetism literally happening, during this sequence. That's, even though he's like scary looking, he's still, for, as you said, sexy in his, in his way. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. It's that weird swagger that, like, for some reason only this movie could pull off, with this weird combination of all these different tones that just kind of bring this perfect, I don't even know how to describe it, but yeah.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I was joking early. I teased it a little bit, of course. You know, so.
He tosses the gun to Chris and tells him to shoot him. So I'm assuming he just, like, he's like, go ahead. Like, it's not going to hurt me. He's not aware that Chris has gone to the bookstore and got the silver bullets.
I got to get those appraised by a jeweler.
Poor Walter Paisley. Yeah.
Tell me. Chris does shoot him a couple of times as the tape plays the sounds of Terry's death. So it's nice little touch where he gets to kind of avenge Terry's death. At the ritual center, they've decided that they can't let Karen live, so they're going to put her and her friend in a car, set it on fire, and push them off the road. Chris, to the rescue, shows up just in time, but TC moves towards him and says the gun won't do you any good. TC also isn't aware, falls into the same trap as his brother, doesn't know that those are silver bullets, and TC starts to transform, but he drops when Chris shoots him.
This scene is also hilarious when, like, the huge group of werewolves just in a semicircle, they walk up to TC and they look down, their heads move down in unison as they wait for him to get back up again. And then in unison, they all look back up again and they realize he's not getting up.
Wide-eyed. Yeah.
It's so funny.
Jerry still doesn't believe it. And he says, silver bullets, my ass, before getting shot himself.
Oh, I got to do it. Silver bullets, my ass.
I love that part. Oh, yeah. It's so good.
Yeah, I love those sort of vocal transitions that they do them, because Eddie does one earlier too, of course, in the booth scene. It's just kind of a cool effect that they pull off. I mean, obviously it's done in post, but it's just it works. It works when they I don't know what they do. They did the same thing to Robert Englund's voice as Freddy Krueger in the first Nightmare, you know, where his voice is just put through something that just has this monstrously low sound to it. It's really effective. Creepy.
It is.
The doctor is the next one to get shot as he approaches Chris, and he says, thank God, as he dies.
Thank God. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. It ties back into Earl, who wanted to end it all because he just couldn't take it anymore. Like, he's free of, like, you know, curse of the werewolf, obviously. In several movies in werewolf cinema history, they call it a curse. And so, you know, the doctor is free of this curse now.
The other wolves start transforming as they're backed up into the barn and barricaded in. So Chris and Karen grab the gasoline that was going to be used to set Karen on fire, and they set the barn on fire. The werewolves are not going down without a fight, though, and they try to break down the barn walls. At least one of them gets out and attacks the car as Terry and Karen try to get away. They manage to shoot it through the roof, and they're out of danger, right? No.
Of course.
There's Sam on the road. Karen tells Chris to stop, only for Sam to start shooting at them. Chris manages to take Sam down. Chris is good with a gun.
Yeah.
He is.
But Sam has hit the gas tank, and they manage to make it to the police car just as their car explodes. They're now surrounded by fully transformed werewolves who are raging against – I wrote raging against the machine, but
– Those werewolves are the machine.
And one of them manages to bite Karen in the shoulder before the car starts. And unfortunately, it was Bill, as we see his human form in the backseat of the car, because he was shot as well. So as they drive away, Karen says, we have to warn people. We have to make them believe. And luckily, they're in a pretty good position to reach a lot of people. So we're back in the news studio, and Chris says he's not sure that he can go through with this, but Karen says, you have to. It's the first story of the night, of course, the fire at the colony. They reference Jonestown and says that it was a Guyana-like spectacle. Mm-hmm. Weird, Jessica. The last episode you were on, we talked about Jonestown.
Oh, we did. Yeah. It just keeps coming up wherever I go. I can't help it.
And we know that some colony members made it out, as the report says the bodies were found both inside and outside of the buildings. Mm-hmm. She starts to give her eyewitness report, but she goes completely off script. She's not following her teleprompter. And she talks about the struggle between what's kind and peaceful and what is cruel and violent. And she recognizes this as the gift that differentiates us from animals. And she begins to expose the colony, a secret society of violent, monstrous mutations.
There's so much to dig into in this moment, but the fact that she is barely holding it together, both physically and emotionally, even before she starts to transform physically, like she's, you know, she's so sad and she's so scared and just she starts fidgeting physically more and more. It's an amazing performance. I know we've already praised Dee Wallace a little bit, but I don't think you could ever do it enough, especially in this movie, because the way that she can't hold herself together emotionally, physically, she can't keep things in check. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
She knows people won't believe her. So as you alluded to, Jessica, she begins to transform on air. And we see different viewers having different reactions, including the bookstore owner who merely says, oh boy.
and the her co-anchor, he suddenly slips back into his southern accent and says, holy shit.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is such a good callback to that earlier moment.
It's so good. And she's this cute little werewolf. Like,
she is.
It's adorable. It's so sad. She has the single tear roll down. And it's just such a tragic ending. This for such a scary, funny movie, the ending always makes me cry. Well, at least this part of the ending, not the very end. It's
like the cut to commercial, and then it's a dog food. Everything about that is like, it's just takes that emotionally poignant moment and just pulls the rug out from under in a really clever way, though.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, because I mean, when it cut into all the bit, hey, the what are you kids watching? The news lady's turning into a werewolf, and, and all of those things. It's like wow. Things they can do with special effects these days. Yeah. And all those kinds of things. You know, after all this, no one believes her.
I know, except for the one guy at the bar who's watching. It was real. She turned into a werewolf and they shot her. And he's so nonchalant about it. Like, it happens every day. It's like the grandpa from The Lost Boys. Like, the one thing I can't stomach about LA, all the damn werewolves. He just accepts that it's there.
Mm-hmm. And that guy's, like, dismissed. They're like, you're plastered. And he's like, it doesn't mean it's real.
For the longest time, I thought that was Wilford Brimley. it sounds like him.
It does.
Yeah.
It just has that. And, you know, one of the things that that I didn't really know much about until recently is the whole Christine Chubbuck story about the, you know, the newswoman who actually shot herself on air. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this wasn't that far removed from that, though that inspired more directly like a film like Network, for example.
Right.
There are certain callbacks to that real event and also to Network as a film, I think, in that final shooting of Karen as well. And it's very poignant. It's sad. It's weird. It's funny. It's all of these things sort of masterfully executed in this one scene. Dante managed to make it all work is pretty astounding. Mm-hmm. And the more I sort of revisit it and think about it, it's like, how does he make it that funny and that poignant and that powerful and moving and sort of politically sharp-edged and all of these things all at once?
And it's not jarring in any way. Like, it's very seamless and works so well together.
Yeah, it's astonishing. And like you mentioned, Brian, like cutting immediately to the dog food commercial and everybody dismissing it out of hand. Like, it calls attention to, you know, all this commercialism and how jaded people are and how people, you know, kind of get lulled by entertainment into not seeing the truth at the heart of society. Right. And it's, like you say, it's just astonishing bringing all these different elements together into one cohesive scene that brings out so many emotions in you. Like you almost can't process it all at once because there's so much happening.
Yeah.
So what do you think happens to Chris?
Oh, gosh. I actually had never thought of it. Yeah.
Thought of it either, but.
We saw how obviously this is true in real life, unfortunately, but we saw how trigger happy the cops are when they just shoot through a door at Eddie, not knowing whether they're hitting Karen or somebody else or anything. They might have, you know, bust in and killed Chris as well, for all we know, you know. But yeah, he probably went to jail for it because he's nobody believes
that
werewolves
are real. He may well
have
even turned himself in, though.
Or perhaps turn the gun on himself if we're going to go that dark.
Really dark. Yeah.
So back at the bar, a man at the end of the bar orders a pepper steak and a hamburger for the lady. It's Marcia, and she wants it rare.
What a great cliffhanger that is.
Oh, it's my God.
Such a great cliffhanger. And to me, I mean, I know Howling 2 has its fans, but to me, it's a wasted opportunity.
And I have not seen any of the Howling sequels. Same. I always assumed that the next movie picked up from that moment with Marcia out on the loose in L.A., because that seems like the logical place to go. But I'm disappointed to learn that that's not the case.
As far as I remember with the Howling 2, I mean, there's a lot of half-naked Sybil Danning, which, you know. Hey, I'm not complaining about that exactly, but Christopher Lee's in it, and I don't even remember if her character is supposed to be Marcia Quist. I honestly don't remember. I remember so little about the movie, and I only saw it a couple years ago. It just was completely forgettable to me. And I know there's some fans of that film, so. I know Joe Dante is definitely not one of those fans, though. He really dislikes The Howling 2. Christopher Lee disliked The Howling 2.
And I just looked it up. Evidently, Howling 2, the subtitle is Your Sister is a Werewolf.
Yes!
Which is that's such an interesting title. I would want that movie to be good, but alas.
It kind of sounds like something that you would see in the 50s as like a creature feature kind of thing. Like,
yeah, like
it's got that vibe.
It's pretty 80s. as I recall, it's pretty 80s. And in sort of all the ways that people deride 80s cinema, it's kind of what it is. A lot of flash without a lot of substance.
So the movie ends with a shot of the grill, some pepper steak and a hamburger. And now after I watched it, I just wanted a hamburger. So that's the movie.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah.
And at the very end, go now and heaven help you from the Wolfman.
That's right. Yeah.
So what stood out for you other than obviously all the other things we talked about? Anything that we didn't talk about?
I don't know. I just like to touch again on how much I like that it situates it in this kind of seedy, grimy, neon cityscape, which is so smart and clever and unexpected for a werewolf movie, especially at the time, that it's trying to tie it into the human condition and say, this doesn't just happen to people, you know, in specific European communities, you know, where the folklore might be more prevalent, or this doesn't just happen to people in the woods. This happens everywhere because this is something that you have to deal with within yourself as a person. So.
Yeah, to steal from your comment earlier, it unmoors it from the moors.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, because American Werewolf, I mean, as a craft of a film, you know, is really strong. It's a great movie, but it doesn't play a lot with with sort of the established folklore of the werewolf. You know, the way it executes it is modern and for the time and unique, and it still holds up, I think. But this one really tries to subvert it. This one really goes out of its way to try and do something that you haven't seen werewolves do before. And not just in a technological transformation kind of way, but actually, you know, setting and abilities, and you know, the only sort of classical werewolf thing that seems to really be occurring is the silver bullets.
Yeah.
You know, everything else is just sort of like, ah, nah, they can change it anytime they want, and they turn into wolves. They're not wolf men, you know. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing. The only thing is they're bipedal still, but right. You know, it's interesting that it's really seems to be going out of its way to kind of do, even though there hadn't been, you know, like you said, so many tons of werewolf movies. Mm-hmm. It was going out of its way to say, we're not the Wolfman, mm-hmm. you know, whereas American Werewolf was kind of like, it starts out on the moors.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like the slaughtered lamb. It's like, yeah, we're a modern Wolfman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, which is great too. You know, and I don't think I can disparage either film. You know, they're so right. different, and they're both great in their own way. And I kind of, you know, I feel like I've been a culprit here. It's so easy to compare them, but they're so different. It's easier to contrast them, to be honest.
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting that you brought up Scream earlier, because they do, you know, much like Randy kind of lays out the rules of slashers, they do say, well, we acknowledge that these werewolf movie rules exist, and here's where they're right and here's where they're wrong. Like
right.
Consciously playing with those tropes and kind of telling people, you know, a movie about not everything you see in movies is real, and here's how werewolves really are, really playing with those tropes. So I like that comparison, but yeah, I love that it really wants to dig into those tropes and, you know, apply them to the real world and apply them to psychology and kind of the human relationship with sex and desire and the social boundaries and niceties that we have to deal with, and also just be so meta before everybody called everything meta. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, even when you're talking about Cursed, I mean, it's almost like, well, you can, because they wanted to do this big, we're going to take the werewolf in a whole new direction. It's going to be a meta werewolf movie. It's like, well, it's the Howling kind of already did that, you know?
yeah.
And, you know, and that's, like I said, I mean, Cursed is kind of fun for what it is.
I love that it ties in the pop psychology, which was starting to become really big in the late 70s, early 80s. Well, I guess actually 60s, I would say, and still kind of continued that self-help journey. Like it plays on that so much as well. And it's such a clever take on it.
Yeah. And without making fun of it, like there's the, you know, Donna's line about trying all these different things and trying Scientology, but it's not really making fun of people who want to better themselves or people who are struggling with mental health. And, you know, like we talked about how it's a really sensitive, nuanced portrayal with Karen struggling with PTSD and trauma. Like it's not a mean-spirited satire of people who are trying to help themselves. It's really kind of digging into the different ways that people struggle with identity and with desire and kind of reconciling their image of themselves with how they really are.
All right, body count. I think it's undetermined. I don't really know how many werewolves died in the fire.
Yeah, there's no way to know for sure.
Yeah.
We had Terry, Bill, TC, Jerry, Dr. Wagner, Karen, and Eddie for sure. Am I missing anybody that we definitely know is dead?
Did you say the sheriff?
Oh, the sheriff, right. Sam. Yes, thank you.
Yeah. I love Slim Pickens.
Oh, yes.
He's so funny. Like, what you girls need is a good retriever.
I love a good pun.
Yeah.
So how many scaredy cat screams would you give it on a scale of 1 through 5?
I give it a 5 out of 5. I adore this movie.
I agree. I'm the same. I give it a 5 out of 5. And I know I said this on the last episode I was on, but man, I just love this movie so much. And you know, yeah, it's 5 out of 5 for me too.
Yeah, I think I do that every time, because I've talked about Black Christmas and I've talked about Slumber Party Massacre. Like, I'm always like, this is the greatest movie that's ever been made. But it is such a great movie. It's amazing.
Well, the last episode I was on was The Exorcist. So.
Oh my God. Well, yeah.
So, you know, maybe this isn't, you know, quite 5 out of 5 like The Exorcist is 5 out of 5, but it's 5 out of 5 for what it is as, at that time. Exactly. You know?
Yeah, you have to meet the movie where it is, I think. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys have been on really good episodes. Although I don't think I've covered a movie that I haven't really loved yet, so.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I don't know that I will. I don't know if there's value to that, but we'll see.
Right, yeah, it's much more fun to, even if you have issues with a movie and you kind of dive into the issues, it's more fun to talk about things you love than to talk about things that you hate, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just seems so mean-spirited if you talked about something that you hated, like why? It's kind of like when you see people on Twitter, like, just absolutely bashing a movie, and I'm like, why do you need to do that? Like,
yeah, like there are constructive ways to criticize something, and for sure, I just like dunking on things, and I'm not a fan of dunking on things.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Share what you love.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on and talking about The Howling. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
So where can we find you?
I am on Twitter at We Who Walk Here. I write for Film Cred and Nightmarish Conjurings and Ghouls Magazine and Daily Grindhouse. So yeah, just come say hi. I love talking about werewolf movies and all kinds of horror and other things and posting stupid cosplay photos and lots of other fun things at We Who Walk Here on Twitter.
Can you do a Marcia cosplay?
Oh my God. Yeah. I will never in my life be as sexy as her, but I'm definitely going to do a Marcia cosplay. It's going to happen.
I love it.
Awesome. Okay. And I'm on Twitter at Brian D. Kuiper. I know I'm really wishing I had picked a different handle. So I write for Bloody Disgusting and Manor Vellum, the third part of my Wes Craven series should be out by the time this goes live. And so hope that people will check that out. Something I'm really very proud of. And let's see here. Check out my podcast with Michelle Egan, which is Movies for Life at Movie Life Pod on Twitter.
Awesome. I'm excited to read the third part of your Wes Craven
series. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at @CatScaredy and on Instagram at @ScaredyCatsThePodcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts. And don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.